Sibelius is At the Castle Gate, performed by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Thomas Beecham, ending this edition of Private Passions. The producer was Elizabeth Burke, and the series is a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. And you might like to know that you can download the programme if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. Next week, Michael Barclay will be talking to Adam Nicholson.
Wagner's Tannhäuser at the BBC Proms. Continuing this season's anniversary focus on the music of Richard Wagner, the tale of a troubadour who yearns for spiritual redemption, the woman who loves him, and the man who loves her. The BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and conductor Donald Runicles continue their acclaimed Wagner partnership at the BBC Proms. Tonight, from 6 o'clock on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock and this is David Cornett with a summary of the news. Britain, the United States and the European Union say they have concerns about the elections in Zimbabwe, which have seen President Mugabe returned to office and his ZANU-PF party take a commanding majority in Parliament. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said there were irregularities before and during polling day. But the President of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, has congratulated Robert Mugabe on his re-election. One of Scotland's most senior Catholics is expected to apologise on behalf of the Church for 3 decades of physical and sexual abuse of pupils at a boarding school in the Highlands. The Bishop of Aberdeen, Hugh Gilbert, is to address the claims of abuse by monks at Fort Augustus Abbey. More than 20 US embassies and diplomatic missions across the Middle East and North Africa are closed today because of security concerns. The British Embassy in Yemen has been shut until Tuesday, and the Foreign Office has advised against all travel to the country. The new Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, is due to be sworn in to office shortly. It's expected that he'll use the ceremony to unveil his first ministerial appointment, a US-educated economist, as his chief of staff. The swearing-in ceremony will be attended by a number of heads of states and representatives of dozens of countries. Police in Tunisia say they've shot dead a suspected Islamist and arrested at least 4 others in a raid on a house south of the capital, Tunis. The government, led by the moderate Islamist Ennahda movement, has been under pressure to act against Islamist extremists, whom it's blamed for the assassination of a prominent opposition politician last month. The Australian Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, has called a general election for the 7th of September, 6 weeks after being returned to office. Mr Rudd ousted Julia Gillard in a leadership contest in June. His Labour Party faces a tough battle to remain in power. And the weather: rain and showers in the southwest of England and Wales will spread northeastwards through the day. Otherwise, it'll be fine and dry. BBC News and weather at 1:04. And time now for today's Early Music Show, which is the second of 2 programmes this weekend, celebrating the music of the English Renaissance composer John Dowland. It's introduced by Lucy Skeeping.
We're always keen on anniversaries on the Early Music Show. They help to focus the mind on a particular event or, as in today's programme, on a particular composer. And perhaps rarely has one man come to personify early music quite as much as John Dowland, whose 450th anniversary of his birth we're celebrating this weekend. Of course, Dowland's image in the popular imagination may be partly to do with the instrument he's so closely associated with. To many people, the classic Tudor minstrel is a fellow singing to a lute. And that's something John Dowland did better than just about anyone else. What's more, he perfectly reflected the fashion of the time, the cult of melancholy. It was no good giving a well-educated courtly audience some merry ditty. Lute songs needed to be mournful, and the more desperate or lovesick, the better.
If my complaints
Barbara Bonney, the singer there, and Jacob Herringman on the lute with If My Complaints by John Dowland. John Dowland was a complex character, a man who had an interesting and eventful life and who, like most musicians during this golden age of English music, depended on powerful patrons for his living. Like so much of the early repertoire, though, his music was virtually forgotten by the 19th century, only to be rediscovered in the first decades of the 20th, in the days when performers were only just beginning to dip their toes into the repertoire, and when much discussion was given over to authentic vocal styles, deciphering manuscripts and, not least, how to reconstruct, or indeed actually play, period instruments. So today, to honour, if you like, both Dowland himself and the journey made by interpreters of his songs from then till now, I'm delighted to be joined here in the studio by the world-famous voice of early song herself, Dame Emma Kirkby, and also by Jacob Herringman, one of today's leading lutenists. Welcome to you both, and thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I hope you won't mind me saying that you've both been around quite a long time on the early music scene. So perhaps more than any of today's performers, you are able to look back at some of the first modern day exponents of Dowland's lute songs. I mean, would you say that we can still learn from them?
Without a doubt. I'm not convinced that things move in an evolutionary way. I think they move in more of a cyclical way. And we have interesting stuff going on at all times, really, I think. Well, growing up in the States, I was lucky enough to hear a lot of the recordings by the New York Pro Musica made in the 1950s. And the countertenor Russell Oberlin was singing with them from about 1951 onwards. It's something to do with hearing something when you're young. But his singing is in my bones. And I love his voice. I love his singing. And it's a unique countertenor voice because it sounds completely effortless. It sounds like a very high tenor.
It is a tenor, that's the thing. And it has, therefore, that vigour somehow. We do have some vigorous countertenors, but it's obviously a bit more likely that a tenor is going to seem very robust, really.
There's a very special sort of trumpet-like quality to his voice. It's beautiful, ringing, clear sound.
Song by John Dowland, the countertenor Russell Oberlin. Now, in my introduction, Emma, I did sort of imply perhaps that Dowland was nothing except melancholy all the time. It really wasn't quite like that, was it? Because some of his songs are really quite amusing.
Well, yes, and also, I mean, a contemporary source, there's not very much information about his life, but somebody said firmly he lived a life of lawful merriment. So in his own life, he wasn't a depressive, and one shouldn't jump to conclusions because he was wearing a melancholy mask for some of his creations. That was the fashionable and satisfying and philosophical thing to do. It didn't actually mean that you were certifiable and needed to be on drugs or anything.
The song I thought we might hear now, it's you singing. It's called It Was a Time When Silly Bees Could Speak. Did Dowland write those lyrics?
No, this is the Earl of Essex. Can She Excuse is his very famous one, and that's called the Earl of Essex's Galliard. This one, in one version, is called the Earl of Essex, His Buzz, because he is a bee who's frustrated because he's a worker bee and the drones are getting all the favour at court. And it's just full of wordplay. And yes, it's grumpy, but it's very funny.
Never found the time would favour me. All the
was a time when silly bees could speak. Emma Kirkby, the soprano, with Anthony Rulli, lutenist. So let's get a bit of a wider picture about Dowland's world. I mean, who would have performed these songs? And more to the point, in what situation were they for, say, a countertenor or soprano or a tenor? Who was Dowland aiming at?
Well, most of the songs are quite kind of middly, and almost any voice could sing them, including tenors, but it's not desperately high. But some things, I think, work better for tenor than soprano because of hearing the words in a certain way. And we do know of the Queen's favourite tenor, Robert Hales, who sang one very significant Dowland song, His Golden Locks, in 1590. That was a special presentation. Sir Henry Lee wanted to retire, and he set up this little staged event to impress the Queen how he wanted to retire and pray for her instead of jousting for her as he had been doing, and so on. And the tenor was hidden in a tent, perhaps for John Dowland himself, singing this song. So when he's described as a tenor, we don't even quite know what that means, because some sources say the tenor was the natural voice of man, which really means baritone. So these days anyway. So when you say tenor, you're not thinking stratospheric high notes. You're thinking a sort of middle-sized speaking range man's voice. And the same for women, I would say. In England, women did not sing in public at the time very much, but they would have sung plenty in their own houses. There were quite big musical households within the families. They had chests of viols that they brought out in the evenings, and everybody sang. And the boys, I'm sure young boys and women, would have sung the high parts. I think everybody had a go. And there's certainly a very famous clip of Thomas Morley at the beginning of his book, A Plain and Easy Introduction to Music, where someone complains at the beginning, I need to learn about music. I had this really embarrassing experience of going to dinner with a family, and afterwards they brought out part books and earnestly requested me to sing, and when I said I could not, they asked where I had been brought up. Everyone was supposed to be able to pick up a part and sing it at sight.
Well, whether we quite know what sort of voice was used, I must say I'm very keen on the sound of Robin Blaise, who does a marvellous job in this song, In Darkness Let Me Dwell.
Ground shall sorrow.
In Darkness, Let Me Dwell by John Dowland. Robin Blaise, the countertenor there, and Elizabeth Kenny, the lutenist. You're listening to The Early Music Show here on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skipping, and today we're listening to exponents of John Dowland's lute songs, both past and present. And I'm talking to Emma Kirkby and the lutenist Jacob Herringman. Of course, there's so much word painting and interest built into these Dowland songs, isn't there?
It's enormous, yes. I think when you look at those seemingly sad creations, you have to register the joy and the satisfaction of the person who's put their thoughts into such brilliant form. You know, there is definitely a sort of pride. I'm feeling awful, but I found a great way to express it. That's, I think, is the joy of this music. You don't just classify it as sad, because there are so many nuances to be found within that rather blanket word.
And Dowland himself wrote that tears are sometimes about joy and gladness, mm-hmm. rather than about melancholy or sadness.
One of my very favourite texts, which I wish I could sing, but it is one of those ones that I prefer to hear a tenor do, because it's got floaty top notes, which sound so gentle in the tenor range, is called I Must Complain. Dowland published it in his third book in 1603, and the words are by Thomas Campion, one of the finest lyricists of the age. And it's quite interesting, Dowland did not set very many Campion texts at all. In fact, it might be the only one. I'm not sure, but if there's one more, it's only that. This is the one I know. And the interesting thing about this setting, it's magical, but also Campion himself very possibly referred to it a couple of years later when he brought out his book, and he said something like, I'm aware that my words have been set by others, and I am content that they then served their turn, but give me leave here to present my own. And he then printed in that book his setting of his own poem, I Must Complain, which is much plainer. It just gives you this extremely clever poem in a rather simple way. It's very effective. When Dowland gets onto it, he really goes to town with it and makes extraordinary effects. And these are the things we know Campion disapproved of. He complained in another preface about people who chained the pieces with fugue and baited them with syncopation, which is exactly what Dowland is doing here, playing with the rhythms.
I must complain, yet do enjoy my love. She is too fair, too rich in beauty's parts. Fancy's my grief, for nature
tenor Charles Daniels with John Dowland's song I Must Complain. And the lutenist there was David Miller. As far as the lute part is concerned, is Dowland sort of super recognisable because it's more complex, or is there something, you know, you could always say, oh, that's very Dowland-esque about the lutes?
Mm.
Yes, yes. I mean, especially if we're talking about Dowland and Campion, because Dowland's lute parts are much more worked out. Fugal, full of imitation, full of technical difficulty. Of course, Campion's lute parts on the page look very sketchy. That doesn't necessarily mean they would have been played exactly as written on the page. One could, as it were, Dowlandize a Campion lute part, or at least, you know,
At least you would, if you did, you would be risking his aggrieved response, I think.
That's right. But when you see Dowland's lute parts, you get the sense, this is complete. This is, if yes. I can manage to play all this, great, I'm happy.
Yeah.
When you see Campion's lute parts, you think there's a lot of freedom left to the player. Dowland, as a lute player himself, worked all this out very carefully. And there's a sense that, well, I find anyway, that I can't think of anything that would in any way improve on what Dowland's done. On the contrary, I try my best to render more or less faithfully what he's written.
But it's not always just the lute that accompanies these songs. There are times when Dowland writes for viols as well.
Yes. Well, he wrote magnificent actual dances and the seven Lacrimae Pavans, which is just astonishing music. But within the song context as well, you can put the lower parts on gambas anyway. That can sound lovely. And then in the middle of his last publication, 1612, A Pilgrim's Solace, there are three extraordinary pieces, one in Italian and two in English, which all call for a treble part. It's sort of obbligato, this rambling line that just it's a quite a big range and quite florid. And the voice and this treble instrument dialogue together. It's actually very beautiful. And there's a rather vintage performance I've only just come across by Andrea von Ramm, who was one of the real pioneers over in Basel in the 60s. And she's doing a lovely job with this, I think. It's called Go Nightly Cares.
Oh,
song by John Dowland, Go Nightly Cares, performed by Andrea von Ramm. Of course, we've been talking at the moment about one voice, but I just still feel that the Consort of Music is unsurpassable when it comes to the four-part singing. I think it's wonderful.
I think it's because we put in the time, actually, and I wish people still did. But there was a good reason, in a way, why other people hadn't got around to it and were less keen, because the middle parts are incredibly difficult. The soprano and bass, that's a nice, generally a nice airy tune and an interesting bass line. And the alto and the tenor have to be athletes. It's extraordinary. They sing these extraordinary cross rhythms. They have to be gentle enough not to drown anyone. It's a real skill, and when it's right, it's electrifyingly fun, but it's about as far from your standard singing voice that you learn at music college as you could imagine. You really have got to be quite self-effacing and extremely clever. And it's something I think that amateur singers were more likely to have a go at, particularly in those days when they were so well-educated, their grasp of clever phrasing and words was so great. I mean, they were definitely the sort of people that Dowland was publishing for were extremely skilled. And of course, the books were printed in this extremely user-friendly way. On one double spread, you've got everything. You've got the top line, whether that's soprano or tenor, and the lute on one page, and the other page has the other three parts sort of sideways so that they could sit round the table, each one seeing their own part. It's a brilliant idea and very economical of paper, but it also makes for lovely ensemble, I should think.
One next to the ladies, chief choice big and new, good many words, but mighty cannot move. I keep it there, but for the fairs of you, a beggar may be liberal of love. Though all my ways be trash, the heart is true.
Fine Knacks for Ladies, performed by the Consort of Music, directed by Anthony Rulli. And on the top line was one of my guests today, Emma Kirkby.
Fine Knacks for Ladies, cheap choice, brave and new, good penny worths, but money cannot move. I keep a fair, but for the fair to view, a beggar may be liberal.
Well, that was somebody we wouldn't normally expect to be singing lute songs. Who was it, Emma?
That was Sting, being four people. And one has to admire it. I mean, he's got an extraordinary voice that can do all those pitches and very well in tune. And I do admire it a lot. I'm not sure I approve in the sense that I do love with the four-part air to hear the different characters of the voices. But to be fair, I mean, Sting himself has since then gone round on tour with a group of young voices and let them loose in that way. So they're the nearest group that have started doing this repertoire, as I'm hoping everyone will. And also on Sting's recording, my favourite track probably is The Lowest Trees Have Tops, which is a dear little bit of philosophy. It makes some very clever points, but is ultimately a rather sad, melancholy song of a jilted lover, perhaps. And Sting, of course, catches that mood perfectly.
The lowest trees have tops, the ant her gall, the fly her spleen, the little spark is heat, and slender hairs cast shadows low but small, and bees have stings, although they be not great. Seas have their source, and so have shallow springs, and love is love in beggars and in kings. Seas have their source, and so have shallow springs, and love is love in beggars and in kings.
The Trees Have Tops, sung by Sting. Any particular examples, Emma, of performers who really sort of bring the text through?
Well, I think one of the earliest influences on most of us was Nigel Rogers, an amazing linguist anyway. In any language, Nigel was, the words were there, crystal clear and beautifully pronounced, but also a huge intelligence and a lot of fun. You would never get a boring version from Nigel. he really gets the best out of, I think, particularly the scheming songs, the cunning songs, these sad love songs that are really just seduction songs. You know, I'm feeling awful, but please give me a hug.
Shall I sue? Shall I seek for grace? Shall I pray? Shall I prove? Shall I strive to a heavenly joy with an love? Shall I think that a bleeding heart, or a wounded eye, or a sigh can ascend the clouds to attain so high? Shall I think that a bleeding heart, or a wounded eye, or a sigh can ascend the clouds to attain so high? Silly wretch, forsake these dreams of a vain desire. Oh, bethink what high regard holy hopes require. Favour is as fair as things are, treasure is not bought. Favour is not won with words, nor the wish of a thought. Favour is as fair as things are, treasure is not bought. Favour is not won with words, nor the wish of a thought. Pity is but a poor defence for a dying heart. Lady's eyes respect no more in a mean desert. She is too worthy far for a worth so base. Cruel and but just is she in my just disgrace. She is too worthy far for a worth so base. Cruel and but just is she in my just disgrace. Justice gives each man his own, though my love be just. Yet will she not pity my grief, therefore die I must. Silly heart, then yield to die, perish in despair. Witness yet how fain I die when I die for the fair.
witness yet how fain I die when I die for the fair.
The tenor, Nigel Rogers. Jacob, when you do have song with such a sort of interesting and kind of text on many levels like this, and perhaps a really imaginative interpreter as well, is it a bit of a panic to, I don't want to use the word accompany because we've already sorted that one out, but is it difficult to work with them on the lute because they might either do something spontaneous or take liberties, or is that allowed?
Well, the best approach from the lute player's point of view is to know the words almost as well as the singer does. You can sort of tell when someone hasn't paid much attention to the words. There's something bland about it. If you follow the words closely, then yes, you know what's coming, and you have an overall sense of the sort of conceit of the poem, and then maybe you're better prepared when the singer does something a little bit unpredictable. But it's very important, I think, to play those lute parts intelligently and thoughtfully.
What you're saying there puts me in mind of the late, great Robert Spencer, who seems to have been such a sort of iconic figure these days.
And he's a great example of attending to the words. His first priority was getting the words across. And it was very refreshing that he didn't mind transposing lute songs, arranging them, doing whatever was necessary to make them comfortable for the singer to sing, so that it could be entirely about the words and not about you know, technical difficulty of singing in the wrong register or something. For him, the words were paramount, the rhetoric of the song, communicating something with the song.
We're going to hear a vintage performance from the 1960s, I think, with Alfred Della.
Come again, sweet love doth now invite, thy graces that refrain, to do me due delight, to see, to hear, to touch, to kiss. With thee again in sweetest sympathy, to hear, to see, to touch, to kiss, to die. With thee again in sweetest sympathy, come again that I may cease to mourn for thy unkindness. I sigh, I weep, I faint, I die in deadly pain and endless misery. I sit, I sigh, I weep, I faint, I die in deadly pain and endless misery.
Tenor Alfred Della singing Dowland with lutenist Robert Spencer. Did either of you know Alfred, or at least hear him live in concert?
I didn't know him, but I heard one concert not very long before he stopped, and it was amazing, I must say. And it was in St Bartholomew's, Smithfield, so it was a perfect setting as well. And the main thing I remember was what he did with his hands, actually. He was sitting, I think he must have done it all from memory, and with his hands he did amazing things. I wouldn't call it sort of authentic historical gesture. It was more like telling the story with his fingers, and it was riveting. You couldn't take your eyes off it.
Because we don't really know, do we, how people spoke or pronounced words necessarily, although there has been lots written and discussed about it. But in those days, all sorts of rhymes start coming in and new meanings and double entendres when you have a sense of perhaps an original pronunciation. What about singing in that way?
It's a bit of a minefield, I think. It can sound wonderful, no question, but you can have surprises. I remember years ago, Professor Dobson, who was the big authority at the time, first of all saying to us, why are you bothering with this? There were four or five pronunciations current at the time, and which one are you going to choose, and so on. But once we'd, you know, he'd got over that warning, as it were, he mentioned things like, you'd think duty and beauty, they rhyme these days, that they didn't then. So some rhymes, you find new ones and you lose some as well. But I think it's a beautiful effect. As long as people have the words to look at, you can get confusions. The word shepherd swain would be pronounced swine, and a bird is a beard. so those are minor problems. Of course, you get over them very quickly.
I think period pronunciation is a very useful and interesting thing. And as Emma says, when it's done well, it's very convincing and it sort of reveals something fresh in the music. And in a funny sort of way, when we're listening to something slightly unfamiliar, i.e. not modern English, we perhaps listen more closely to the words. Mm. I think we get a bit lazy when we're listening to a song in our own language. And so if that makes it a bit fresher and a bit more, if it makes us a bit more attentive, I think it's a good thing. On the other hand, if Bob Spencer were here now, perhaps he would say, but nothing must get in the way of communicating the words and what they're about. And I'm very much of two minds.
That's been my excuse most of the time,
yes,
I must say.
I
love to be understood immediately.
Yeah.
Have you worked with a singer recently or recorded someone who sings with original pronunciation or what we think is original pronunciation?
When Catherine King and I were recording Dowland, we did quite a lot of work with a scholar by the name of Alison Ray. And Catherine does some, I think, very convincing performances of Dowland in period pronunciation. And it was a very interesting process going through that. There are a lot of question marks about how certain sounds were pronounced, and there's a lot of debate. And as Emma said, there were several pronunciations current then as now. But that was a very, very interesting experience.
John Dowland's Burst Forth My Tears, Catherine King and Jacob Herringman on the lute. So what about the future? Where do we go from here? You two obviously have enormous experience and you're very generous with what you know. What's the next generation up to, and are they as open-minded perhaps as these early pioneers in the 1940s and 50s, or more so perhaps?
I think possibly more so, actually. I think the young people now in colleges, they know everything, in a sense, everything's on offer. And I think there's more openness in the colleges than there was when I mean, not that I was at college, to be honest, but that's in a way significant, because I probably wouldn't have got anywhere if I had gone to a music college in the 70s, because I simply wouldn't have fitted any kind of frames they had then.
No, I mean, I studied the lute with Diana Poulton and at the Royal College, and it was still considered quite a weird sort of thing to be doing. I mean, what about you, Jacob? Do you, some of the lutenists coming up now, are they just kind of an everyday instrument?
Well,
it's still considered a bit weird.
It's a completely different field for them. I mean, I can trace my last 25 years. 10, 15 years ago, I think I more or less knew everyone who was playing the lute in this country. Now I couldn't possibly know everyone who's playing the lute in this country. There are more and more people. And there's a body of recorded material for people to listen to, which there wasn't 30 years ago, or much less anyway.
Do you have a favourite young lutenist you think is really going to go places when it comes to Dowland, of course?
Well, I definitely do, because I've just returned from the York Early Music Festival, and there I heard Yeston Davis accompanied by Thomas Dunford. Now, Thomas is a very young player who I first met when he was 14, and he had already been playing the lute for a long time. And he is playing beautifully, and he will continue to play beautifully, I'm quite sure. So he's very encouraging to hear him doing Dowland.
So one to watch. What about you, Emma? Can we hear anything from an up-and-coming group?
Alongside the tracks we've already chosen for this discussion, many of them are by people I've known for quite a while, and they're younger than me, but not that much, and so on. When it comes to the next half generation, there are quite a few people. There is a perfect Dowland miniature piece called If That a Sinner's Sighs Be Angel's Food, and it's barely 2 minutes long, incredibly touching and searing. It is about the denial of Peter and how we relate to that as human beings. And again, it lies high. It's one of those ones I would have said must be tenor. But Aileen Monaghan Thomas has done it with David Miller, and the result is exquisite.
Ooh.
If That Sinner's Sighs Be Angel's Food by John Dowland, sung by the soprano Aileen Manahan-Thomas with the lutenist David Miller. Lucy Skeeping was talking to Emma Kirkby and Jacob Herringman about the music of John Dowland, and you can see details of the actual music played on the Radio 3 website. Today's Early Music Show was produced by Helen Garrison.
After an absence of almost 20 years, piano soloist Mitsuko Uchida returns to the BBC Proms, playing Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 in the first of two BBC Proms concerts given by the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra and its chief conductor Maris Janssens. A pair of concerts culminating with Mahler's Second Symphony, The Resurrection, on Friday. Join me, Christopher Cook, for the Bavarian Radio Symphony Orchestra at the Proms. On BBC Radio 3, Thursday night from 7 o'clock.
And now a chance to hear an edited repeat of last Friday evening's Prom. It was presented by Clemency Burton Hill.
Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. Clemency Burton Hill here with you on Radio 3, home of the Proms. Now, piano concertos are a big theme across the Proms this season. And we're going to hear one of the greatest of them all, Rachmaninoff's Third in D minor. First performed by the composer himself in 1909, it's often said to be one of the most technically challenging pieces in the entire repertoire, so fiendish indeed that many pianists have confessed their fear of performing it. Rachmaninoff himself declared, "I much prefer the third because my second is so uncomfortable to play." And our soloist tonight, Nikolai Lugansky, seems to agree.
I think this is really probably the highlight of the whole history of piano concerti, and actually this is great joy, I think, both for public and for the performer. So it's written so pianistically, so beautifully. It's really such a beautiful piece, both musical and physical feeling of beauty on piano. So fear, you know, everybody is excited before the performance. I have really very personal relation to this work when I studied it from zero until I could play it without score in 3.5 days. Nobody believed me, but I was young, strong, and I was really, it was great passion to do it. Of course, I didn't play very well, but I played it from beginning till the end without the score.
In 3.5 days?
Three and a half days. I practiced, of course, a lot, and I knew music, but knew music from melodies and studied on piano, of course, a big difference. I played, of course, many times this concerto, but every time it's different, every time it's a challenge, always a lot of risk, elements of risk, but still I enjoy playing this piece always. Of course, I have some fear, but generally it's great, great joy to play this piece, and especially in such a fantastic condition for, like Royal Albert Hall, when it should be great fun.
Well, he's making his way to this stage. Coming on now to the stage of the Royal Albert Hall, Nikolai Lugansky. He'll be joining the Royal Scottish National Orchestra and their new conductor, Peter Ungern, to perform Rachmaninoff's Third Piano Concerto in D minor.